coming at you all the way live from the lower bottoms of West Oakland. This is Revolution. Lots going on in the world. We're still in the middle of the COVID lockdown. Here in California, they've released some of the restrictions mildly, but our children are still learning remotely. We're looking at millions of evictions, I think, countrywide. We're looking at potentially 30 million people losing their homes now that the moratorium is up. Unemployment numbers, I think this past week as we're doing this show, was down. It wasn't a million people filing for unemployment for a change, but the unemployment are still off the chain. Today I have with us show economist, homie, Arash Kolai. What up?
What up? Happy to be here, as always.
How you living?
Living good. Trying to get through.
I was trying to have Brother Kolai on a couple weeks ago, and the timing didn't work out. And I had some economy questions for him. And if you're not following Arash on Twitter, you need to get up on this. There's definitely going to be a link in the show description again to his Twitter. But he has these Twitter threads that will always explain the current situation very concisely and beautifully. And it'll always end with a little bit of hope. And he has one thread in particular that I want to read, kind of about the state of the economy right now. It's a little lengthy thread. It says, imagine the economy as a train roaring towards a precipice. All that is needed to avert catastrophic disaster would be for a few levers to be pulled. Long ago, the first class cabin was bailed out with trillions. What will be the fate of the remaining 99%? In a functioning democracy, there would be some correlation between the will of the people and which levers are pulled. But this train is not a functioning democracy, and there is zero correlation between the will of the people and which levers get pulled. The two-party corporate-owned duopoly, quote, two factions of the same corporate party, both elevate the interests of corporations and the 1% over the interests and desires of the population. That's why the first class was bailed out first, while the 99% sit and watch the fast approaching cliff. Poll after poll show both parties, including the Democratic Party, are far to the right of the U.S. population. The small differences that do not exist reflect the small differences within different factions of corporations and the 1%. And I'm going to stop right there, and I have to ask, did you watch the RNC, the Republican National Convention?
I did not. I could not get myself to do it. I didn't watch either of them.
Oh, word. I was going to ask if you watched the Democratic one.
No.
I watched about 5 minutes of the RNC. I couldn't really get through it, but I had a guest on that brought up an interesting point about the RNC. Justin Hunt is actually down in your neck of the woods. He was like, well, you know, Trump had frontline workers at the RNC, and the Democratic Party kind of all they did was bring out a bunch of anti-Trump Republicans. And they really paid no fealty to the working class. And there's something to be said. I watched Trump's press conference yesterday. Or not press. It was either a press conference or it was a rally. Those two things kind of are one and the same.
Yep.
But he kept talking about how he's so pro-union and he's all about the working man. And it's interesting when you hear him talk. Because I just did a show with a professor that wrote a book. And it's called "Is Donald Trump the Emperor of the Lumpen Proletariat?" And it was comparing Trump and Napoleon the Third in Marx's 18th Brumaire, writing about how Napoleon the Third came to power.
Mm-hmm.
By kind of galvanizing this lumpen proletariat.
Mm-hmm.
And there definitely is something to be said about Trump and that faction,
mm-hmm.
using them as almost like a military force.
Yeah.
And playing off that, that the Democratic, the, if the Democratic Party is the party of the donor class,
mm-hmm.
Trump plays off that very well.
Yeah.
With the whole coastal elites thing.
Yeah. And Biden totally plays into it and consistently is running to the right of Trump on a lot of things. I mean, he's going out of his way, bending over backwards to show how conservative he is, which is demoralizing to the vast majority of his base. It's pretty bad.
And from an economic standpoint, neither party is really talking about real solutions. Trump makes stuff up about Joe Biden being this weird socialist that I'm still trying to figure out.
Yeah. He's beholden to the radical left, supposedly.
It's like nothing Joe Biden has done in his Biden-ass life. Joe Biden could die and come back and live another 80 years and still not be to the left of anything he's ever done.
Yeah.
God damn, you can't just make shit up like that. And then just people go, you know what? Kamala Harris and Joe Biden is some socialists. I was like, man, what is a socialist to you then? Because you don't think you know Kamala Harris.
It would be a comedy if it wasn't so catastrophic. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's almost laughable, but then, you know, the problem is that there's real consequences to what's transpiring before our eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is it like by you in Southern California?
I mean, people are struggling, you know, people are struggling, I think, everywhere. But, you know, from what I see and what I hear, savings are dwindling. You know, the sorry excuse for what was the stimulus, obviously has ran out for most people long ago. And then with the ending of the unemployment expansion, it's been very tough for the vast majority. And kind of what I talk about in the thread, unless there really is going to be a significant, a real bottom-up stimulus, we're headed for a cliff. You know, just to give one example, if over the next couple of months the economy doesn't pick up, it's estimated about 40% of small businesses are going to go permanently closed. That's, you know, a little over 20 million jobs that will be lost permanently. And that's obviously catastrophic, but it's going to generate a downward sort of death spiral, right? When you have that high of an unemployment rate, obviously people won't be able to spend on the things that they need, and it just causes a really bad economic cycle. So it's bad, and it's looking like unless some real things happen, it's going to get drastically worse.
Do you think, I don't know if I shared it with you or not, there was an article in Business Insider and it was talking about how companies like Dunkin' Donuts and Chipotle were buying up all this land because all these companies, to your point, all these companies are going under.
Yeah.
These small local shops are going under, and these major multinational corporations are coming in here buying their land and getting ready to set up shop.
Right.
Are we looking at possibly the Walmartification of not just small town America, but kind of Main Street America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if, you know, like I said, unless something drastic is pushed through over the next, you know, month or so, I think there's going to be probably one of the largest consolidations of corporate power, unlike something we haven't seen in decades. You know, like you said, real estate will be bought up, or just, you know, the larger corporations that have been bailed out will just replace the smaller businesses, right? So it's really going to drastically alter the economic landscape of the country. It's and of course that has a whole host of repercussions, right? I mean, when the more things get monopolized, the less bargaining power consumers will have and employees will have. There'll be less competition, and it will just accelerate. Although it's been accelerating for quite some time, but it will further accelerate the disparities of wealth, right? Because, you know, 40% of this lifeline of these small businesses, right? And small businesses provide 50% of the private sector jobs, right? So it's half the jobs. And as those get dwindled out, we're going to lose, and, you know, within the context of capitalism, obviously, you know, as you and your listeners know, I'm very anti-capitalist, but within the context, we're going to go to a much worse, much more degraded form of capitalism, if this happens, right? So within that sort of framework, we're going to lose a lot of what today would be considered decent and good paying jobs. And we will have more and more, and it will be replaced by more and more lower paying jobs. So, and that's, you know, like I said, it's going to, and it's, and these things tend to work in cycles. And that's one of the, you know, really important lessons that unfortunately we didn't learn from the Great Depression, right? Is that these sorts of downward spirals, they kind of feed into themselves, right? So as businesses see that consumers are spending less, which of course they're going to be spending less because, you know, unemployment's going up. Well, what are they going to do? They're going to cut back their workforce. They're not going to invest in productive capacities, right? So they're going to cut back. And when they cut back, then, you know, unemployment will go up further. And then when unemployment goes up further, then they're going to cut back more. So that's why I call it a death spiral. That's how we got to the Depression. And the only way to get out of that type of a death spiral is through, you know, the work of Keynes and others. We need a massive bottom-up recovery that would get money into the hands of the people who need it most, right? The problem with the top-down bailouts, which probably shouldn't even be called a bailout when it's top down, is that the corporations just hoard the bailout, right? Corporations don't spend one additional penny on anything, right? Whether it's expanding their capacities or it's an additional penny to hire an additional employee. They're not going to spend one additional penny unless that additional penny spent will return more. I mean, it's just the logic of capitalism. Why would they, right? Why would they? They're not going to. They have no incentive to. And so what happens is exactly what we saw and we've been seeing over the past couple months. A lot of hoarding of capital at the top. A lot of, and obviously, actually, this even happened before the crisis when the Fed was pumping trillions into the financial markets. But at that time, corporations were using their excess capital to buy their own shares and to increase the prices of their own stocks. And that's the logic of capitalism from the perspective of these corporations, right? They're not going to spend an additional penny if that penny is spent is not going to bring them some profit. So that's why top-down bailouts have never worked and will never work. The only way to get out of this is to get money into the hands of the people. You know, I was a big supporter of Sanders' $2,000 a month plan. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways we could go about it. Other countries had guaranteed their salaries to all employees in the country for the duration of the pandemic. That's another way to go about it. There were lots of solutions, and unfortunately, none of those, because going back, you know, to the thread, regardless of the desires and all of these, you know, like the $2,000 plan, I believe was supported off the top of my head by like 70% of the population, right? Something close to that. Mm-hmm. These types of policies are wildly popular and wildly supported across the political spectrum, right? Even, you know, just like Medicare for All. I mean, even the majority, obviously the majority of Democrats supported it. I don't know what it was, like 80%, close to like 80%, but even like in the 60 percentages of Republicans supported. So one of the things I talk about is that, you know, there are solutions, and we didn't get any of the real solutions, right? We just got mainly just bailout for the top. We got some crumbs, you know, we got that $1,200, some people got that $1,200 check. There was some, you know, unemployment expansion, but it was pathetically too low to prevent the type of catastrophe that is likely going to happen unless, you know, like I said earlier, there really is a real bottom-up recovery plan. Short of that, it's not looking good.
It's interesting you use the metaphor of a train and the economy is like a train with the 1% in the front cabin. It reminds me of a movie from 2013 Bong Joon-ho, mm-hmm. who did Parasite.
Mm-hmm.
If you've seen the movie Parasite,
I have. It's
a great film.
Yeah.
Before he did Parasite, he did a movie called Snowpiercer.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but it's funny because in the comments, like a few people mentioned that movie. Like, oh, did you just watch that? And I was like, no, I don't even know what that is. And then I searched it and I was like, oh shoot.
it's a great film, and that's literally what it is. Mm. It's kind of a great big metaphor, as if you've seen Parasite. He definitely does metaphor very, very well. And he makes it, in my opinion, I feel like he makes these stories for the left that we really need to understand and like watch. And the story of Snowpiercer is there's this privileged class of people. It's a post-apocalyptic world. Is a new ice age, and this man figured out how to make a train run perpetually. I kind of don't want to give too much away, even though you should have seen the movie. It came out in 2013.
But I will watch it by our next session.
Dude, you got yeah. So you got to see it. But Chris Evans, Captain America, is a dude that did not grow up in the train, but he remembered how bad things were before the train, when I guess people were turning into cannibalism. Because there was just nothing to eat. And so the very, very poor in the back of the train. And as you go closer to the front of the train, you see how the privileged class live. Like, the back of the train looks like just an encampment, if you will. There's just dark. It's really dirty. They're given these kind of jello bricks of you don't know what to eat. And every so often they just snatch kids out of the back, and you don't know what they're snatching the kids for. And the whole movie is, of course, Chris Evans is moving through the cars till he gets to the front of the train. And again, I don't want to spoil it for you. But yeah, the metaphor you use of the train and the 1% being at the front, I'm like, oh damn, that is so Snowpiercer. And that movie does end with a smidgen of hope at the very end of it. But yeah, it's like, I guess when the train goes around the earth one time, because I guess it's the tracks are so long, it's all around the world. That's one calendar year. And there's a lot of interesting metaphor in that movie that is kind of over the top, not as subtle as I felt Parasite was. But you know, in those movies, we're really seeing this class discussion.
Yeah,
that I feel like we don't really have in the U.S. as much anymore. Because it devolves into a race discussion.
Yeah.
And that kind of like, I don't know. it's hard to bring those things back.
Yeah. It's important, you know. I mean, we definitely live in a highly classist society, to say the least, on, you know, multiple levels. And, you know, these are important conversations to be had.
And how do you think we push the conversation to have a better bailout? Because once again, there's just so much happening with the pandemic. We were talking off air a little bit about the depression people are just going through, being kind of stuck, and life being so different. Like, excuse me, not being able to go outside and just eat at a restaurant. Like, I just kind of want to go to a restaurant, but I don't want to go to a restaurant. Like, I'm scared.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we're social species. You know, human connection, human touch is core to like who we are. So definitely, you know, I think that's a huge part of it. You know, and obviously there's things that we can do to kind of do better, you know, to connect with others, to reach out to others and show, you know, empathy and compassion towards one another, which I think is very uplifting, in these times. But like you said, there's multiple crises that we're witnessing at such a astonishing pace that it can feel paralyzing. It can feel demoralizing, as if like we just can't keep up, you know? And part of like what somebody, you know, like Trump, that is almost every, like just dominates every news cycle, with just the most outlandish comments or statements or, you know, falsehoods or whatever. And of course, you know, the media just gobbles it up and allows for every cycle to just be dominated, by, you know, his rhetoric. There is that element too of just the constant sort of feeling from whether it's the mainstream media or even on social media, just a constant stream of what oftentimes feels as, you know, a very like a waterfall of like just trauma, you know, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. just like every day we're like, oh my God, like, did that just happen? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, one day it's the post office is being dismantled, you know, which, by the way, you know, over 90% of the population supports the post office and supports it as a public institution, not as a business, but as a public institution. And it's just like another, you know, it's just another news cycle. And so I think the velocity of these types of news cycles is very, it's sort of traumatizing. And I think it's really important to speak to that, because there's, at the same time, there's also so much, you know, hope. There's a vibrancy right now in conversations. I feel like windows are opening up that in my lifetime, at least, I have not seen publicly open up, you know, on social media and in other circles. Millions of people are out on the streets, right? And of course, the media plays this sort of both sides kind of nonsense, right? I mean, like, you have millions of people marching versus, like, you know, 600-700 like Trumpers, you know, causing all kinds of havoc. And the way that it's presented is very demoralizing, right? And I'm just talking about the mainstream media, right? I mean, obviously, on the left, there's definitely good coverage of what's happening. But if, you know, for people who are kind of just getting their information from mainstream sources, it's definitely a huge mental health traumatic sort of experience that's paralyzing, that's demoralizing. And I think a huge part of what we need to do on the left is really cut through that. You know, we can't just fall for every you know, news cycle soundbite that that comes from, you know, Trump. I think we have to define our own agendas and not just kind of be at the whim of whatever, you know, garbage is being spewed out of his mouth. And so that's one part of it. And then the second part is the, you know, the demoralization. I think there's so much hope right now. You know, people are in the streets, you know, from Black Lives Matter to the anti-fascist movement, to people are organizing and trying to organize general strikes. So there's a level of activity that's just unprecedented. So you can also look at it from, you know, a historical context of unprecedented hope and unprecedented conversations that are happening, verging on, you know, almost onto the mainstream. Obviously, the mainstream is not, you know, covering, you know, anti-capitalist perspectives, but you know, like we're seeing people are questioning things that they weren't questioning before. And I think that's the door that us on the left need to go through and have that conversation with people, which coincidentally are like the same, you know, people that these right-wing conspiracy, you know, QAnon and whatnot are going after, mm-hmm. right? It's like people know, like, everything's fucked up. You know, people know everything's broken. Mm-hmm. They feel it. Like, they feel it in their bones that everything's broken. And centrism, business as usual, doesn't speak to people's hearts because it doesn't match the level of pain that people are feeling in their lives. It doesn't match the level of alienation that people are feeling in their lives, right? Mm-hmm. But a radical left perspective, a systematic perspective, a system analysis would blow, you know, QAnon out of the water, right? You know, where they talk about these like dark shadows and whatever garbage and blame, you know, they blame immigrants and so on and so forth. You know, it's all obviously the wrong targets. They blame everything but the actual truth of the matter, which is the system is the problem, right? So I think people are desperate for answers. They're desperate to understand why they feel so much stress and so much anxiety and so much, you know, alienation in their lives and so much, like, it's so hard, you know, like, why is life so hard for so many? And they want answers. And I think that's a door that the left needs to walk through and have a conversation if we're serious about winning, like, radical change. Right. If we're serious about getting to a point where we can actually understand the systematic flaws of capitalism and to be able to overthrow that, the systematic racism that is in this country and to overthrow that, and the sexism and all of it. Right. I mean, it's all of these oppressions are connected in a lot of ways. And to get to that point where people have a consciousness of understanding the institutional and systematic roots of the pain that they feel, I personally feel that's the conversation that needs to be had. And that's where I personally feel we move the conversation from despair that people are feeling to hope that a real better world is possible. Like, not, you know, hope in the Obama sense where like literally nothing changed. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, rhetoric, but real hope that a better way is possible, right? Like, we could have an economy that is, you know, run, you know, as a participatory democratic workplaces where we're not, you know, that's not environmentally degrading, that people are rewarded equitably for their efforts. And you know, those who are unable to work can receive a, you know, an average dignified income. You know, same thing with other forms of oppression. I mean, I think understanding that, you know, it doesn't have to be this way and getting to the heart of these systematic problems, I think is really how we move the conversation from despair to hope and from hope to action and from action to real change.
I mean, do you think we need to start just building our own kind of alternatives to the system that we live in, opposed to constantly asking for this change?
Yes and no. I think there's a lot that could be learned from it, but it's also the stacks, you know, it's stacked against you, right? One of the, like, if we just look at the economic sphere, you know, one of the problems with markets is that it creates like a race to the bottom, right? The competition between enterprises is that the market will actually cause, no matter how benevolent and good-hearted we are, right, it will cause our competitors to fare much better than us, because they don't give a shit, right? Like, if they don't care about the environment and they don't care about their employees and they don't care about any of the stuff that we don't care about, they will probably put us out of business pretty quickly. So one of the problems and one of the challenges, and I'm not saying it's not a worthwhile effort to, you know, start a co-op or something like that. Of course it's a worthwhile effort, but we have to understand that it's a systematic problem, and you would be at a huge systematic disadvantage versus raising consciousness of the flaws of capitalism, that markets create this sort of competitive environment that drives towards, you know, the lowest common denominator, that drives towards the worst of the worst become the ones who rise up, because they are the ones who will externalize as much of the cost as possible. Coming to that consciousness, I think, will lead us to ask, okay, so what is the alternative, right? And I think that is the direction that we eventually need to go. You know, not to say that we shouldn't go for co-ops. Obviously, you know, it's better, but again, you know, it's an uphill battle, right? When you're fighting against a flawed system, it's an uphill battle, right? It's better to just go and fix the system. So that all workplaces that are run, you know, equitably and democratically and so on and so forth are not at a disadvantage, right? So that there isn't this like race to the bottom, this race to the worst common denominator, right? And that's, I think, eventually where we need to get going.
And isn't that kind of the problem, though, with the system that we're currently in, is that you have people like Jeff Bezos, who was it $200 billion?
Yeah,
he's worth now, and made so many hundreds of billions during the pandemic. Like, he's not making his workplaces better to the point where, you know, the young man Chris Smalls organized a strike. And what my guess for the current show that's up now, Justin Hunnett, said, he goes, why wasn't Chris Smalls at the Democratic National Convention? Especially if the Democratic Party is supposed to be, well, it hasn't been for some time, the party of labor.
Right.
You know, here you have kind of the ultimate labor movement. Like, it gets, if you want a narrative for the left, it gets no much better than, you know, here is the mega corporation. Mistreating its workers to the point where people are dying of the virus that's infecting people to make them use the service. And one worker, one very regular person, says, enough. This can't be. You need to clean these facilities properly and give us the proper protection to wear. And it's not even like the healthcare ask.
Yeah.
It's just can you just clean this, please?
Yeah. No, I mean, on multiple levels, that's just very disappointing. You know, obviously, the Democratic Party has really shown that, at least, you know, from my perspective, they're not willing to do anything that would jeopardize, you know, the corporate class, the donor class, and the 1%. They would rather lose than veer towards, you know, even, like you said, not even asking for, like, health, you know, universal healthcare, just asking to, like, not die at work. Like, that's the not most, a big ask. That's not a big ask, right? But the, you know, putting themselves in a position where they can be portrayed as even the slightest of threat to, you know, like you said yourself, the donor class or the corporate class, they're not willing to do it. And I genuinely believe, and kind of just looking at the way this campaign is run, it just seems like they would rather lose than just do what, like, literally the vast majority of people in this country want. Right. I mean, we're talking about, you know, I have another thread where it's like, I think the lowest percentage I even talk about is like 65%, right? But some things are as pretty much close to like 80%, right? Like 80% of the population believes we need to get money out of politics, right? We need to have radical changes to the way campaigns are financed to get corporate money out. Like 80% of the people know it's just dirty and just... it's just people, you know, that corporations just buying politicians and they're buying favors. Like 80%. I mean, you could win, I think, handedly, the Democrats could win on, you know, these types of policies that the vast majority of people support, right? Another one, obviously, we talked about earlier, like Medicare for All, like, you know, that's like over 70% or 70% of the population supports that. You know, another one I think was like 68% of people support increasing taxes on extreme wealth. You know, and things like that, I think they're not willing to touch, right? So even at, you know, even at the risk of losing, it seems like they're not willing to go there. You know, a lot of people are excited about the People's Party. I don't know if you've heard about that as a potential, a new political party called the People's Party, where looking to bring a new third party into the mix that truly reflects, you know, these types of values and these types of policies that are wildly supported. So I think there's some hope in that.
It's interesting that you say that. I just spoke with Gloria LaRiva earlier today, mm-hmm. who's running for the PSL ticket. Mm-hmm. Party for Socialism and Liberation. Mm-hmm. And then I do speak from time to time with Angela Walker, who's the VP candidate for the Green Party. Mm-hmm. And I love talking to both of those wonderful ass, amazing women that are just, they're constantly in the struggle. They're constantly fighting for the working class. I feel like people really want real change, and I think the Obama cult of personality election led to Trump, and there's a lot of people that are afraid and they don't really like the junior high class president kind of election that we get every 4 years. where it's just someone promising you no homework and, and extended lunch periods.
Yeah.
That they're following these third parties, which are kind of, you know, they're to galvanize the left. And the sad thing is, I feel like Bernie Sanders, who's let's just be honest, he's a lifelong politician. I don't think he's a bad person. Mm-hmm. I don't see much change happening from within in the Democratic Party. They flexed on him so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Twice.
Yeah.
That 2016 might have been his year to really make a real third party. Now, if I'm wrong and Trump does get reelected, my fear with a Trump reelection is that he does something that we haven't really seen in the States that I can remember. You might have a better grasp at history than me of having his brown shirts, if you will, the Proud Boys, mm-hmm. the Patriot Pack or whatever they're called, the Boogaloo mm-hmm. movement, which I found out was named after Break Into Electric Boogaloo.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Why would they desecrate such a great movie?
I have no idea.
I watched that with my son the other day. and that he can actually disperse this lumpen proletariat, if you will,
mm-hmm.
to really crush any sort of real rebellion to his authoritarian movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the only, I don't want to say good thing, the only positives I can see out of another Trump 4 years is that it seems like it's really radicalizing a lot more people. Like I feel like Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders is kind of, his movement radicalized a lot of people. And then after he got flexed on, the Trump administration has just radicalized so many that we're saying words like socialism in public, and it's not mm-hmm. a bad word. DSA mm-hmm. is growing in leaps and bounds.
Right.
Left media is growing in leaps and bounds. And these things that we want are seeping into the lexicon of that centrist, even donor class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Ellen and The View have to acknowledge defunding the police as a real rallying cry,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, that means that a change is a brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it could possibly get stronger under another 4 years of Trump. My mm-hmm. fear is that 4 years of a Biden-Harris campaign means that these people that are so anti-Trump now that have pretty big microphones, even people that you and I may not like,
mm-hmm.
those they just turn those microphones off, and it's back to, you know, brunch and finding out what the Kardashians did or what right. Kanye West said.
All right. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, there's definitely a lot of, I think, strategic questions, you know, and even I myself have been kind of thinking the same as you, you know, which scenario is better or worse. And obviously, you know, like the criticisms we hear about Biden, you know, at least that I see, you know, on social media and, you know, in my own circle, you know, they're all valid. They're all true. And mm-hmm. obviously he's extremely racist. He has a history of racism, a history of, authoritarianism himself, mm-hmm. a history of supporting the consolidation of corporate power, a history of sexism and so on and so forth. I think, you know, one way, and again, I don't ever punch down. I don't ever voter shame. I think people, you know, and these are just perspectives that I think about, but I'm not, you know, going to tell anybody how to vote. But one thing that I consider is, you know, who do we want to fight under? And I feel, I look at, you know, and you mentioned historically, I think that you can look at some of the most brutal and horrific dictators in history, or even currently. And I think you will not necessarily find that they're any closer to a revolution, right? Just because they have this, you know, brutal authoritarian, they're not necessarily closer to overthrowing what is oppressing them. Mm-hmm. I think the variable to what actually gets people closer to that sort of revolutionary moment is what we were talking about earlier, is raising consciousness and raising hope and believing that a better way or a better system is not only possible, but is infinitely better, right? I mean, it's the pain and the alienation and the stress and the constant crises and the trauma, like that could be over, you know what I mean? And we can live in a more liberated and free society. And I think that's, to me, I think that's what gets people closer to a revolution. Not the fact that you have this brutal dictator that is just so horrible, right? Or even poverty, right? I mean, you look at countries with horrific, horrific poverty are no closer to revolution than we are. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I don't think that just because, you know, if 4 more years of Trump will lead us not necessarily lead us to having more people being politically involved and more people active and willing to fight for a new society, right? I think, you know, I think under a Biden presidency, which obviously in a lot of ways is not remotely close to being ideal, but I think we wouldn't have some of the more horrific things that we would have under Trump, which, you know, you alluded to, like the brown shirts, you know, race war, this constant sort of psychosis of trauma and understanding how the mainstream media of this country works, like it is incapable of getting through, I think, a second Trump term, and getting us to a better place at the end of that term. So I don't know. In my estimation, while, you know, all of these critiques that we have of Biden are all valid and true, I'd rather be on the streets, you know, fighting against capitalism, against racism, and against all these oppressions that we're fighting against. I'd rather do it under a Biden presidency than the sort of lawless and reckless and hostile Trump presidency. But, you know, like I said at the preface, I'm not necessarily telling anybody how to vote, but that's sort of you know, my line of thinking.
So not to be all doom and gloom about Biden, but I told you I interviewed Michael Harris, who wrote this book, Welcome to the Rebellion, about mm-hmm. Star Wars. And we got done recording the show, and we're having this conversation after the fact. And after this conversation we have for a couple hours, I come to the conclusion that Joe Biden is indeed, and you've seen the Star Wars movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden is indeed the Emperor.
Hmm.
And Trump is just General Grievous. So if you go back to the Revenge of the Sith movie,
mm-hmm.
where no one knows where the where the other Sith is, where there's always two, and they're trying to stop Dooku and Grievous. And all along it was Palpatine, who's not yet Emperor Palpatine. Mm-hmm. That's how I look at Joe Biden at the moment. Mm-hmm. Like he's gonna come in kind of mild mannered, like dude, and then just crush all rebellion.
Yeah, but do you think more
fell for it?
I mean, obviously, during the Obama administration, I mean, rebellions were crushed as well. But mm-hmm. I think, I don't know. I mean, so not. I just feel like there's. I don't know. You could be right. you really could be right, but I don't see Biden doing some of the sort of race war type of stuff that Trump is doing out in public.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
No, not at all.
And the type of sort of getting the boogaloo and, you know, the QAnons and getting these types of people out into the street to fight sort of a lawless war against the left. I don't see that happening under a Biden administration. At least not to the extent that it would happen under second Trump administration. And that is happening now, you know?
Yeah.
yeah. No, that is literally happening now. So, I don't know. I mean,
I don't see the Biden-Harris campaign playing that level of three-dimensional chess like you saw in the Star Wars prequels, which are about how a world or a country turns into fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Like how does one go from a somewhat democratic republic to a fascist one?
Mm-hmm.
And then how does that, when you overthrow that fascist regime, how does it fail? Which was a lot of what that book was about.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting through the lens of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look through the lens of Star Wars, I think we always look at Trump as the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think he rose to power pulling those kinds of strings.
Right.
It's just kind of a thing he wanted to do and he did it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Joe Biden, like, you know, I think he feels that this is just his time.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, the Democratic Party wanted to put him, as the candidate, which still kind of baffles the shit out of me when mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders had so much momentum mm-hmm. and really has galvanized the country behind like real working class issues.
Right.
But maybe you're right. Maybe the Democratic Party, I shouldn't say maybe you're right. You are right. There is no maybe. The Democratic Party cares not about the working class.
No. No, I mean, look, I mean, I think a lot of the corporate class, the 1%, are less threatened by a second Trump administration than they are threatened by the type of political and economic galvanization that would happen under Sanders, which explains exactly what you're describing, right? Mm-hmm. Why would they pick Biden over Sanders when clearly Sanders would have brought so much excitement from the working class, from young people, you know? So I think that explains it. I mean, to them, you know, I think they prefer Biden over Trump, but they prefer Trump over Sanders.
So strange. Like, we talk about freedom. We've definitely had discussions about freedom and there's no better kind of example as much as you hear Trump talk about China, how free are we when we don't pick the president? We think we do, but you can't even get Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and Howie Hawkins on the same stage.
Yeah.
The Green Party presidential candidate.
Yeah.
Imagine what would happen if people actually got to see that level of debate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I'm going to end with this. I'm going to read your last thread. Trying to prevent an economic recession / depression from the top down is like trying to push string. The more you push, the more slack develops, but nothing moves along. Corporations will keep hoarding their capital and won't hire employees or invest in the real economy. Corporations won't spend one additional penny on hiring workers or additional capacity unless that penny returns more pennies. And that doesn't happen unless consumers have money to spend on the goods and services they need. Top-down bailouts, like what we've seen over the past few months, never work, never have, and never will. They only function to further redistribute more wealth to the already wealthy, which is exactly what we've seen over the past few months. As the financial markets, large corporations, and the 1% receive trillions in handouts, the real economy, the economy that affects you and I, is headed for a train wreck. Damn. Damn. So you got to watch Snowpiercer tonight, man. I'll give you the Netflix login if you need it, homie.
I will, but let's not end this on a train wreck, though. Let's add. I feel like we gotta add like one sentence. I don't want to end this with like the last word being a train wreck, because we got to.
Then
they're not gonna do it. We got to fight. We got to fight against it. I don't want to see a train wreck. We got to organize.
I'll end it with another quote from you. I'll be fair.
All right.
when the levers that could save us are controlled by the first class cabin, who've already saved themselves, and the standard channels have no semblance of democracy, we've got to demand and force change, strike, civil disobedience, and movement building. I can dig it.
That's a better way to end. Oh.
You know, we have, you and I both have children, and it frightens me to see the world that they're heading towards. My oldest son is a senior in high school, and before the pandemic hit, he swam since he was like probably 8 or 9, maybe even younger than that. And this was the first year, last year was the first year he stopped swimming. He's like, Dad, I'm going to lift weights. I want to play football. I've been asking his little black ass to play football since he was a little kid, and now he wants to play football. And he's working out, and he's getting all buff. And I'm just so proud. And every time I see him, a little tear wells up in my eye, because I'm like, God, I love the hell out of you, son. And I'm watching him go into this senior year via Zoom.
Yeah.
No prom. No graduation like you and I had. All the fun stuff you got to do senior year. It's just different. And if we don't try to fight for a better world, then what are we doing?
Absolutely.
So that's why I fight. It's one of the reasons why I fight.
Me too.
Oh, I know you do. Is there anything else you want to promote, young man?
No, I think that was good. we got through a lot. We got through a lot.
All right, well, don't hang up. I'm gonna play some music. Thank you once again, Show Economist, giving us the rundown on what we're really looking at with the real economy, the economy, and a little bit of hope at the end.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on, man. Don't hang up.